A man named Kuroshek described these treaties, which were discovered in the early part of the 20th century, and his work was published in 1931. Then an Old Testament scholar named George Mendenhall pointed out the parallels between these treaties and the biblical covenants, specifically the covenant at Sinai. And his work was first published in 1954. Right at this time, Professor Meredith Klein, teaching at Westminster in Philadelphia, he was beginning his Old Testament career, came across Mendenhall's work and began to appropriate his insights. His first published work, in which he appealed to Mendenhall and Kuroshek and others as well, was a book called Treaty of the Great King, which was published in 1963. The argument in this book was, you can even tell by the title, Treaty of the Great King, is that he's interpreting the book of Deuteronomy as one of these treaties. And so Yahweh is being pictured as the great king, and Israel is being pictured as the vassal. The book was an attempt to argue against the higher critical views of the Old Testament, specifically the book of Deuteronomy. The higher critics, the liberal scholars, believe that the book of Deuteronomy was basically a forgery that was, in quotes, discovered in the temple during the Reformation under Josiah. It wasn't really discovered, it was just created by the high priest, and he pretended to discover it, and so he attributed it then to Moses. Klein points out that because the book of Deuteronomy contains such strong parallels to these ancient treaties, that helps us to date the book of Deuteronomy, because the treaties that were in existence at that time go back to the second half of the second millennium. That would be 1500 to about 1000 BC, which is during the 1500, of course, is right around the time of Israel and Moses and so on. That may be a little later, 1400. And so by using the parallels with these ancient texts, he was able to argue for an earlier date rather than a date at the time of Josiah, which would be much later. Then in 1972, he published this book that I handed out there, The Structure of Biblical Authority. In this book, what he does is he continues his study of these ancient texts and draws out the implications of it for understanding the issue of the canon. And actually, he says there are two canons in Scripture. We're talking about the Bible itself, and how do we know what books are the inspired Word of God. So the canon refers to the authoritative list of the books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and so on. Klein points out that the concept of canonicity, that is, authoritative binding documents, is very closely related to the concept of covenant. And he shows that these ancient Near Eastern treaties or covenants were also canonical in the sense that they contain within themselves statements concerning the authority of the document. And they uttered curses against anyone who would try to come along and change the document or add to it or take away from it. And so therefore the idea of canon is directly related to the idea of the establishment of the covenant itself. In this book, he has two parts. Part one is canon and covenant, and part two is some collateral studies that bring out some interesting implications for other areas of theology. In the first part, canon and covenant, he begins in chapter one by showing the formal origins of biblical canon. That is, he points out all of these ancient texts between the Hittite suzerains and their vassals and the Assyrian suzerains and their vassals. And he shows that the concept of canonicity is an ancient concept going back to the second half of the second millennium. Then in chapter 2, he draws out the parallels and shows that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is full of covenantal and therefore canonical language. In chapters 3 and 4, he then brings out the implications of this to focus our thinking about canon. So that instead of thinking of the canon as one thing, the 66 books of the Bible, He argues that because canon is so closely tied in with covenant, and since there are two covenants, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, that therefore there are two canons, the canon of the Old Testament and the canon of the New Testament. And this, in turn, has very important implications for how we should interpret the Old Testament and what authority the Old Testament has in the church today. Because if the canon is directly tied to the covenant, then the canon for the New Covenant community is not the Old Testament canon, but the New Testament canon. Now, does that mean that the Old Testament books are not inspired or that we shouldn't include them in our Bibles? No. They have the authority of inspired Scripture, but they do not have the authority of covenantal documents that serve as the constitution or polity of the New Covenant community. That's a very important conclusion, because this has significant implications for specific issues of theology and ethics and practice, areas like church government and so on, where often in the history of theology you'll find that theologians appeal to the Old Testament as if it were still the canon or covenant of the church, rather than interpreting the Old Testament in light of the canon of the New Covenant church, which is the New Testament. Let me just give you an example. What about tithing? Yeah. Should it be net or gross? If you believe that the New Testament documents form the covenantal canon of the New Covenant church, there is no statement in the New Testament requiring tithing. The New Testament simply says, do good to all men, especially those who are of the household of the faith, and those who labor in the word and in the doctrine, they are worthy of double honor. So it simply gives the general requirement to support your pastor. But it doesn't specifically state that you must give 10% of your income. If you believe that the constitution of the church is the entire scriptures, including the Old Covenant documents, then you would have a lot of passages you could go to in the book of Deuteronomy and so on to support the idea of tithing. And so right there you see a very practical consequence of this whole thing. And so we'll look at some of those implications. Then in part two, in collateral studies, Klein simply brings out some additional interesting points. In chapter 1 of part 2, he points out that when you are reading through the book of Exodus and it talks about the two tables of the law, usually what we're thinking of is on the first table it has the first four commandments that deal with our duty to God, and then in the second table, a separate tablet, it has the last six commandments dealing with our duty to man. And that is a traditional interpretation that goes back to the early church, the church fathers, who got that by looking at when Jesus said that the two great commandments are to love God and to love your neighbor. And so they interpreted that as a division of the Ten Commandments into two sections. Klein points out, though, that this interpretation is actually incorrect, and that the two tables of the covenant are two copies of the entire Ten Commandments. And the reason for this is because in the ancient world, when a treaty was made between the great king and his vassal, one copy had to be put in the temple of the great king, and the other copy had to be put in the temple of the vassal. But in God's covenant with Israel, they don't have separate deities or separate temples, right? There's only one God, only one temple, and so both copies are put inside the Ark of the Covenant. In chapter 2, he deals with dynastic covenant, which is dealing specifically with the book of Deuteronomy and how Moses handed off his authority to Joshua. In chapter 3, which we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at, he gives his critique of theonomy. Theonomy is a view that says that the Mosaic law, in all of its exhaustive detail, is still binding on the New Covenant church today, and not just the church, but also on the nations and the civil governments. The civil magistrate has the authority and the requirement to implement the Mosaic law, specifically the punishments for sin and crime and so on. And Klein critiques theonomy by showing that the penal code, that is the death penalty for idolatry and so on, in the Mosaic Law is not a timeless statement of abstract principles for civil government that apply to all nations at all times, but instead it was given for a very specific purpose, and that purpose was to be an intrusion of the kingdom of Christ in type and shadow. And he argues that the entire Mosaic theocracy, where the civil magistrate was not simply a civil magistrate, but was a theocratic agent of God's wrath, that entire theocratic thing was intentionally set up by God to be a picture of the ultimate kingdom of Christ that will come at the end of history. And in a sense has already come in the first coming of Christ, but not in an earthly form. Because of the already not yet, the theocratic kingdom of Christ in the present age exists only in the spiritual world of the church's identification with Christ by union with him and his spirit. When Christ returns at the second coming, though, that's when it will be manifest in earthly form in the judgment of unbelievers. So the whole idea of intrusion then, what he's saying is that the principles and powers of the future, of the age to come, have come into the midst of redemptive history, and God set up Israel to be a microcosm, a little parable, a picture of Christ's kingdom. And he applies that to the Decalogue too, and shows that there's this thing called intrusion ethics. Why is it that the midwives were declared to be righteous in God's sight when they lied about the Hebrew children? Pharaoh said, all the male children have to be killed. Hebrew midwives lied and says, oh, you know those Hebrew women, they're just so vigorous, they give birth so fast, and you run in the room and the baby's already born, nothing you can do. They lied, and that was a righteous thing. And also Rahab, she sent the spies out a different direction. And the Bible just says that these people are just in God's sight. They did what was right, even though they broke the Ten Commandments. And so Klein argues that this is called intrusion ethics. That is, within the realm of the theocracy, there are special principles that apply. Another example is when Israel went into the land and slaughtered the Canaanites. Doesn't that contradict the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill? Why were they commanded to kill? Again, because of the intrusion. And then fourth, this second part here, the fourth chapter, is a very helpful study of the book of Exodus, in which he shows that the genre of the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that particular style of writing is rooted in the Old Testament, rooted in the book of Exodus. Think about the book of Exodus, just in big terms. What's it all about? What's the basic event that takes place? The Exodus, right? So it's all about the ultimate act of redemption and the establishment of God's covenant on the basis of that redemption. And that's what the Gospels tell us about. The Gospels are all about the Exodus, that is, the cross of Christ and the establishment of the new covenant with his people. But in addition to that, there's also a lot of material in the beginning of the book of Exodus that talks about the life of Moses. And so this is giving us the historical background of where did this covenant mediator come from, and talking about his life story. And so also in the gospel records you have information about the life of Christ, who is the covenant mediator of the new covenant. So that's just an overview then of what Klein is doing in this book, The Structure of Biblical Authority. And we're going to go through each of these chapters one at a time. Let's just begin this morning by introducing the whole issue of these ancient Near Eastern treaties. Basically, these treaties were used as a form of international diplomacy. It had to do with making treaties between nations, but not in the way we think of it today. Today, we think of a treaty between two nations as sort of a bilateral equal agreement, United States and NATO or whatever. But in the ancient world, diplomacy between nations was not equal. It always had the idea that there is the overlord and there is the vassal. And the overlord is called the suzerain. The vassal is the subject state or nation that was conquered by the king and made part of his kingdom. Think about the great nations of the ancient world that lived during the time of Israel. Remember the Babylonians and the Assyrians? These were great nations who weren't content merely to have their own nation and their own land. They would go out and try to conquer other peoples and take them under their authority. And when they went out and conquered them, what would they do? Well, you have a clear example of what they did when you read what they did to Israel. What they did to Israel was the same thing they did to all the other nations. First of all, they would cart off, you know, a good percentage of their population, especially the young and the strong and the intelligent, and take them back home to use them as servants in their royal court, like Daniel and his three friends. Secondly, they would utterly remove the subordinate king and destroy him and replace him with a vassal king. Or if he was willing to pay tribute, his life could be spared, and he would have to enter into a treaty with the great king. And then thirdly, they would destroy the temple, or at least bring the articles of the temple to their own temple to show that their gods had to submit to the gods of the conquering nation. Remember in the book of Daniel, when there was that great feast that I think it was Belshazzar had? And what did he do during that? Do you remember what he did during the feast? Before the handwriting on the wall, though, what did he do? Yeah, he served the wine in not just his own, he used the temple silverware, didn't he? He used the cups and the golden service, all the stuff that God told the Israelites to make to serve God. He said he's going to throw a party using the sacred instruments that God had made for the temple. And that was very sacrilegious and very intentional, a way of showing his power over the Israelite God. If the conquered king submitted rather than fighting, he would enter into a treaty with the great king. And the treaty then was this document that defined what the vassal had to do and that also offered protection to the vassal if he was ever attacked. And many of the things that the vassal had to do would, you know, be obvious things like pay a certain amount of tribute every year, you know, 10,000 talents of gold and silver or whatever. He had to make sure that if the king was ever attacked, the great king, that he would raise his own army to support him. He had to promise not to enter into treaties with the enemies of the great king. So he had to be enemies with the king's enemies and friends with the king's friends. He couldn't go to war against other vassals who had also entered into a treaty with the king. And so on and so forth. And these treaty documents are very interesting because they contain all of the elements that we see in the biblical covenants. And here's the format that I've given to you there. This isn't necessarily followed exactly in every single treaty. Some of these elements might be left out, or the order might be switched around. But this is generally what you find. And I brought some to read to you here. The first thing you find is the preamble of the treaty. This is the treaty of the Hittite king Supi Luliumus. I love these names. And he begins the treaty with the preamble, "These are the words of the sun." So he's basically saying he's the sun god. "These are the words of the sun, Supi Luliumus, the great king, the king of the Hatti land," that's the Hittite land, "the valiant, the favorite of the storm god." So right at the beginning, the king identifies himself not just in terms of, you know, earthly political terms, but he identifies himself in his connection with the gods. And who is this king? He's the valiant, the favorite of the storm god. Then after the preamble, there's a historical prologue. And the historical prologue is where the king reviews the historical events that led up to the making of the treaty. And so whatever the situation was, in this case here, he reminds the vassal that before, he had been a vassal of Egypt. And he uses the term to stand in the gate. So he says, before you were standing in the gate of Egypt. But, he says, then you realized the error of your ways, and you came and fell down at the feet of the sun. Remember, he's the sun, so he entered into a covenant with Supi Luliumus. "You departed from the gate of Egypt and fell down at the feet of the sun, and I, the sun, the great king, accepted your vassalage and added you to your brethren." There are other vassals as well. Don't you just love these guys? It's just awesome. The haughtiness, the arrogance. Then after the historical prologue, and also, by the way, in that historical prologue, usually the purpose of it is to kind of inculcate gratitude on the part of the servant, of the vassal, and say, see how gracious I was that I let you come into my kingdom. I didn't wipe you out. I was merciful to you. I saved you. I delivered you from your enemies. So you should do this now. You should enter into this agreement with me and agree to these stipulations that I'm going to give you. And that's the third part, the stipulations. And as I said, you have all these military clauses, dealings with foreigners and other fellow vassals and so on. Then you have the documentary clause. And this is the part that Klein is really interested in this book, The Structure of Biblical Authority. Let me just read to you one here. This is from the Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon. He was an Assyrian king. Listen to this statement. He who changes, neglects, transgresses, erases the words of this tablet, or falsifies the oath of this treaty tablet, and then it's kind of broken off there, you can assume though, let him be judged or something. If you do not respect as your own god, Asher, the king of the gods, and the great gods, my lords, or the image of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, or the image of Ashurbanipal, crown prince designate, or the image of the gods, I think is what it says, not sure, etc. If you remove it, that is the treaty, or consign it to the fire, or throw it into the water, or bury it in dust, or by some trick destroy, annihilate, or turn it face down, which would be symbolic for saying it's no longer valid, then may Asher, king of the gods, who determines the fates, decree for you evil, unpropitious fate, and not grant you fatherhood, old age, etc. And may Ninlil, his beloved wife, the wife of the god Asher, induce him to pronounce evil for you, and may she not intercede for you. And may Anu, king of the gods, rain upon all your houses disease, exhaustion, di'u disease, we don't know what that is, sleeplessness, worries, health, ill health, and so on. And it just goes on and on. It talks about vultures feeding on you, and etc., etc. And this is a curse that's being added specifically to the, not just to the stipulations. If you disobey the stipulations, then you'll be cursed. It's a curse if you physically efface the tablet on which the treaty is found. And this is where the idea of canonicity comes from. The idea of canonicity is saying, this document is authoritative. This document is absolutely binding. And you don't have the right to change it or to add to it or take away from it. Only God does, because he's the one that made this covenant, this treaty. The documentary clause also will include a certain ritual that would have to be performed every so often, let's say once a year. The vassal king would have to go into the temple of the gods, retrieve the treaty tablet, and then read it, or have it read to him, to remind him of all the requirements of the treaty. That reminds you, doesn't it, of the way the king in the Old Testament was supposed to read the document every 7 years at the Feast of Tabernacles. After the documentary clause, there is the divine witnesses. And the divine witnesses is a long list of all the gods that are going to come and get you if you don't keep the covenant. You know, it just goes on and on, this big list right here. You are adjured by Anu, Enlil, and Ea. You are adjured by Sin, Shamash, Adad, and Marduk. You are adjured by Nabu, Nusku, Urash, Nergal. You are adjured by Ninal, all these gods. The gods of Nineveh, the gods of Kala, the gods of Arbala, the gods of Kalzi, the gods of Haran. The more gods, the better. And so all of these gods then are being called as the witnesses to enforce this treaty. So even if the king happens not to see your disobedience, the gods will notice and the gods will come and take care of you. And then finally there's the curses and the blessings. And these are very similar to the curses and the blessings in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. In fact, let me just read a few here. From the treaty vassals of Esarhaddon. If you sin against this treaty which your lord Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, has established with you, may Pilal, lord of first rank, let eagles and vultures eat your flesh. May Ea, king of the Apsu, lord of the springs, give you deadly water to drink and fill you with dropsy. May the great gods of heaven and earth make oil and water an abhorrence to you. May Gura, who provides food for young and old, burn your offspring and descendants. Just as rain does not fall from a copper sky, so may there come neither rain nor dew upon your fields and meadows, but let it rain burning coals in your land instead of dew. Let there not be rain or dew. That's almost exact echo of the biblical curse in Deuteronomy 28. And then the blessings. Let's see here. Well, I can't find it. Not all of these covenants have blessings, especially the Assyrians. They were pretty rough dudes, so they just had curses in their covenants. So anyway, these are the things that these treaties helped us with. When we saw these, when these discoveries came out in the first part of the 20th century, it helped then to clarify what's going on in the Old Testament. And some of the key places then where you see this, we've already alluded to it, that there are really three key moments in the Old Testament where this whole covenant treaty idea comes out. The first is in the Sinai covenant that God makes with Israel at Mount Sinai. And that whole covenant, really it's the tablets, right? The tablets of the Ten Commandments. But in terms of where it's found in Scripture, it's basically that whole section from Exodus 19 all the way through Leviticus, the end of Leviticus. And it's interesting, if it's hard to think that way because of the break, you know, at the end of Exodus, and then it begins a new book in Leviticus. But if you really think about it, it starts off in Exodus 19 with God coming to his people and saying, I am the Lord your God, right? So there's the preamble, identifying who he is, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, historical prologue. That's why, therefore, you should keep these stipulations. Then all the stipulations are given, and the stipulations go on all the way until Leviticus, all the way through Leviticus. And then at the very end of Leviticus, what do you have? In Leviticus chapter 26, you have the blessings and the curses. And so if you think about that whole block, that's really a covenantal treaty unit. The second example of this is the book of Deuteronomy. Now, the book of Deuteronomy is really not a separate covenant in the sense of being a new covenant arrangement, but it's a reenactment of that same Sinai covenant a generation later with the wilderness, with the generation that survived the wilderness. Remember, after Sinai, they disobeyed the Lord when the spies came back and brought a bad report and said, oh no, let's not go up, it's really scary in there, those giants, you know. And so God wiped out all of that generation except for the children and Joshua and Caleb. And so that the children then had to be given the covenant again. And so Deuteronomy is Moses reenacting this covenant with the generation that survived. And he's doing so this time on the plains of Moab. That is right across the border on the other side of the Jordan River. And they're about to go into the land. Moses finishes giving the book of Deuteronomy. He goes up. The Lord takes him away. And Joshua then comes on the scene to be his successor. And Joshua brings them into the land. Again, the book of Deuteronomy as a whole has the same structure. It begins with historical information. The first, I think, three chapters of Deuteronomy is recounting everything that happened from Sinai up until Moab during that whole 40 years. So there's the historical prologue, but this time it's updated, as opposed to, I'm the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, and stopping there, because that's as far as they were back then. Now it goes on to talk about everything that happened in the wilderness, how Moses had to intercede for them, and how God spared them on the basis of his mercy, and so on, even though he destroyed the original generation. Going through all that historical information, and then you come to the core stipulations of the covenant, beginning with the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. And then expanding on that and showing the implications of it. And then you get to the end of Deuteronomy and you have the blessings and the curses in Deuteronomy 28. You also have the divine witnesses, don't you? Remember the song that Moses wrote? He calls it a song of witness. So it has to be changed a little bit. It can't be witnessing all these gods, because this is a different theological context now, where we're dealing with Yahweh, not with all these false gods. But the basic idea is there. Moses teaches them this song in Deuteronomy 31. And he says, this song will be on your lips, and it will be a testimony against you, so that when you enter into the land and you start worshiping false gods, this song can rise up against you and say, look, you've broken the covenant. And in the song, Moses even goes all the way, and he prophetically, as a prophet, looks ahead all the way to the time of the exile and the new covenant in Christ. And this, of course, Moses' witness song in Deuteronomy 31 becomes the basis for all of the prophetic writings. Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on, they are simply bringing out the implications of what this new covenant is going to be in spite of Israel's failure. And then the third example in the Old Testament is the book of Joshua, Joshua 24. After they enter into the land, what does Joshua do? He says, "Choose you this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And he reenacts the covenant at Shechem, in which they are recommitting themselves again to serve the Lord and to follow Yahweh and so on. And you have the same kind of thing there. You have the historical prologue, and you have the reminder of what the stipulations of the covenant are and so on. Those are the three most vivid examples. It doesn't mean those are the only ones, but those are the ones that stand out vividly as being really clear cases of the parallels between the ancient treaties and the biblical treaties. I've given you there some info if you want to know where to actually read some of these treaty texts. They're kind of fun. These books are available. Pritchard's book, this is the one I have here, James B. Pritchard. This is actually a kind of a shortened version of it. This is called The Ancient Near East, Volume 2, A New Anthology of Texts and Pictures. But he has a larger book called Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament that has even more treaties in it. And then the other one is Parpola and Watanabe, The Neo-Assyrian Treaties and Loyalty Oaths, published in 1988, that deals with the one that I was quoting from, the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon. Those are found there in that book. The Hittite treaties are found in Pritchard. The Hittite treaties are older than the Assyrian ones. The Hittite treaties go back to the second half of the second millennium BC. So that's 1500 to 1000 BC. And the Hittites, of course, lived in modern-day Turkey. The treaty vassals of Esarhaddon, the Assyrian treaties, are later. They come from the first half of the first millennium, so from 1000 to 500 BC. And there are others besides the ones by Esarhaddon. These two types of treaties, the Hittite ones and the Assyrian ones, are a little bit different. The Hittite treaties focus on the historical prologue. The Hittite treaties emphasize the history of the relationship and the desire to inculcate gratitude on the part of the vassal. The Assyrian treaties don't have a prologue, and they tend to have a much bigger section of curses than the Hittite treaties. And so some of these differences then have been used to try to date the Old Testament, because the Old Testament documents clearly have a prologue. Historical prologue is very important. And so that has been used as an argument then that the Old Testament was written during the second half of the second millennium, which is what traditionally we've always thought. Moses lived around 1400 BC, as opposed to being a forgery that was created by somebody living during the reign of Josiah in the 8th century. So that's an interesting point. It doesn't conclusively prove it, but it's just an interesting thing that helps to support the authenticity of the Bible. I'd just like to close then with one comment, and that is, sometimes people, when they hear about this stuff, are a little bit troubled by it, because it seems strange that God would use this pagan treaty idea to convey his grace and his covenant with his people. What do you think? How would you answer that objection? What are some ways that you could say it's not a problem theologically?
Well, I would say that God communicates with the form of communication that exists.
Okay. Yeah, a good example of that is when Paul uses terms like adoption. The word adoption is taken from the Roman legal system, and he's using it as a metaphor to communicate a theological concept, because his audience would understand that metaphor. Yes? Yes. Right. Right. That's a really good argument. He already knew ahead of time that he was going to make this covenant with Israel, so he prepared the way. by historically setting up this ancient Near Eastern culture and allowing them to do that. Right. 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 Good. Excellent. Great.
Maybe one way of thinking about it, just playing off of what Eric said, is that we think of God as incomprehensible, and God in himself as being, another way of saying it, beyond our ability to understand. And we do understand biblical revelation. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And thereby it's a gracious act of God, revelation itself. And so God embodies his own self disclosure in the thought forms and the cultural forms of the world in which that self disclosure occurs. It's not a humiliation of God in the sense that God becomes something less than God and we're desecrating God himself, but rather it's God humiliating himself in self condescension.
Another thing, too, to bear in mind is the basic analogy that's being used here is that the great king, whether it's Esarhaddon or Supiluliamas, the sun god or whatever, is being appropriated as a model for God himself, right? So God is saying, I'm like these great kings in some way. And that sounds bad at first because these great kings were blasphemers, they were idolaters, they were arrogant, they were claiming divine titles and so on. But in another way, you could kind of flip it around and say what those great kings were doing was merely a perversion of the royal authority that God had given to Adam from the very beginning when God made Adam as the head of all of creation. And so Adam's royal kingship and authority, he was made in the image of God. There is a sense in which Adam's authority was divine in some way. It was a godlike reign and kingly authority that he had. These kings then come along, and because of common grace, they still have the remnants of that understanding within them. It's perverted by idolatry, but they understand still by common grace that God made man in God's image. And so then God comes along, and he takes away the perversion and the idolatry, and he restores it back to its proper understanding.
So. You can already see that in the example that you quoted of Ben Patton, because he essentially says, if you don't venerate the image of the great king and his
yeah.
you're getting cursed.
Right.
And so the Deuteronomic covenant comes along as a mockery and says, if you venerate the image of God or any of his associates, you're getting cursed.
Right. The whole issue of the second commandment and making images of God is a polemical, we might call it a demythologization of pagan worship and pagan religion. Demythologization meaning that the Bible is, in a sense, poking fun at these idolaters and their claims to deity and so on, and then using it as a way to proclaim the truth about God. Right. 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 Yeah. And this also applies, I'm sure you've all heard of the Gilgamesh epic, and there's also the Babylonian Genesis or a creation account called Enuma Elish. And if you read these Babylonian documents, which are much older than the Bible, I mean, Moses wrote around the 1400s BC. These documents go way back to the second or third millennium. And a lot of scholars then say, oh, see, Moses was simply borrowing from the Babylonians when he talked about the flood or when he talked about creation and so on. And again, we can do the same thing there and say these were very ancient oral traditions that had gotten perverted among the pagans. And so when Moses comes along, he's not borrowing from them, he's correcting them. and getting rid of all of their idolatrous assumptions that have been mixed into their false traditions, and showing them what the true tradition really is, according to divine revelation. So it's a helpful way of thinking then about this. And I think the key thing is what Josh said, is providence, understanding God's total control, providential control of history. And then secondly, understanding common grace. That even though these guys are pagans, and even though they worship false gods, they still contain within their own minds remnants of the truth. The truth has been perverted, but the truth is still being brought through these pagan cultures in some way. They are still bearing witness to God and to God's covenant relationship with man in the garden, even though the witness is, in some cases, it's an antithetical witness of contrast, but the witness is still there. So I think providence and common grace, those two things can really help. All right, very good. Any questions or comments? Okay. Let's close in prayer.